Hero?
Yes.
Caputo?
Yes.
Dinar?
Present.
Earl? Kevin?
Trying to unmute. I'm here.
Thank you. And Tonner?
Here.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sherry. Agenda item 2, review discussion and a possible action on committee meeting minutes. I'll make a motion that we approve the open session minutes from the 2nd.
Dinah seconds.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed. Agenda item 3, guidelines and compliance with audit recommendations. So the historical interview, Ryan, that was just kind of summarizing some of the things we talked about last time, it looks like.
Yeah, I think we just kind of, oh, sorry. This is questions that you had specifically on the historical overview, and then these are answers. You guys probably know that we contracted with Mary Williams after she's gone, and she's helping because of her historical perspective, and so this is that document. And I think there was 3 specific questions.
Yeah, we had talked about priors, and which was part of the concern of in the Auditor General report. It seemed like the consensus of the committee, but I mean, let's maybe flush this out first, was once the board has established that there was some kind of violation, whether they're thinking disciplinary or not, as long as the consensus seems to be that it would be a minimum of non-disciplinary action, that we would at that point discuss hires. Does that seem like an accurate summation from last time?
Anthony, I have one question. Are you considering letters of concern on that too, or?
My thought, I guess I'm not really giving my personal opinion on it yet, but just from what we talked about in this committee last time, no. I think we were looking at it more as let me ask you, Jeff, are you talking about what priors we would look back at? Like, would we look back at a letter of concern, or what would spark the review of a prior?
Well, my thought was this. So you got 4 options. You've got dismissal, letter of concern, non-disciplinary CE, unprofessional conduct. My thought was if the board was considering a letter of concern or dismissal, they wouldn't go to priors. If they were considering non-disciplinary CE or unprofessional conduct, they would.
That's what I thought too.
Okay.
And I mean, personally, I would agree with that.
I agree with that too.
Is this, because this was highlighted in the report, Ryan or anybody else, I mean, is this something we should vote on with a consensus and then, report back to the board that this is what we agreed upon?
Yeah, I think maybe if you had we could do several different motions, and Seamus would probably weigh in to say sometimes it's easier to keep track of them that way. But if you had some sort of compiled document that you wanted to have for your last meeting, whether that's today or in the future, that you guys have a consensus on, then you can make one motion that encompasses all of it.
I think this is a point that we should take alone, because I think there has been a sense of confusion on the board, at least for me, since I've been on, when we can address this. And I think it would probably be helpful to the board to know what this committee found. Any other thoughts?
Anthony, so what if you were debating and one section says letter of concern and one section says non-disciplinary CE or higher? Do you go to?
I think at that point, so I guess there's a couple ways to do it in my mind, and then let's flush this out. So Dr. Caputo could speak to this. I think the investigative committee takes a separate motion first to establish where that falls before they discuss priors. We could look at that. Otherwise, you know, the chair could just kind of take the temperature of the board. And if, you know, in the case now with me being chair, if I thought there was really kind of a split, then I'd call for a motion one way or the other, before we would start talking about priors. Cause I think what we would want to do is avoid board members being influenced by priors if we are at the stage of potentially a letter of concern, which is, I'm thinking that's where you're going with this.
I am. I like that. I like that approach.
Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I feel strongly that there really needs to be a motion on the floor that would establish that there is a violation before you consider any, you know, I think it's a bad form to say the chair takes the temperature. Okay. You're a really good chair, but sometimes you don't always have a good chair. And I think if we're going to have guidance going forward, it really should be established that you find a violation before, or of either regulations or some statutory violation that would establish the basis for disciplinary action. And then once you've made that finding, you've identified the conduct that is problematic. Then if you look back at your priors and see whether that conduct has been repeated over time, or the licensee has done remediation on that issue, but has done the same mediation 3 and 4 times, like, you know, hands on Crown and Bridge or Endo, and you find that they're just not learning it, and maybe it's the time then to ratchet up what the penalty is.
And noting when the prior was. I mean, you know, if the board's already, say the board has issued record keeping or risk management, and this, now we're looking at a complaint and they haven't taken that CE yet, that should be taken into consideration as well. And I think Jeff brought that point up last time. Addie, go ahead.
So I was going to comment along the lines that Kevin just commented, but with a slight twist, if I may. So I think, I mean, the current practice is, or at least in the past one or two meetings we have done, okay, there is a violation, which is a separate question than, you know, what sort of action should the board take against the licensee, which is great. I mean, that's sort of like at least at a bare minimum, that should be the dividing line, I think, as to when we consider priors. But then when there is discussion, as Jeff Tana was saying, as to, you know, between different types of non-disciplinary actions, that's where it gums up the works a little bit in my mind, because Kevin's approach would be that the board, or maybe the twist to Kevin's approach would be that the board makes a decision that this warrants disciplinary action, at which point, I mean, the precise scope of disciplinary action could be sort of, you know, up in the air at that point, but once the board establishes by voting on a motion that this warrants disciplinary action, then I think at that point we can start looking at priors. The only danger I see in looking at priors when the board is considering non-disciplinary action is we don't know at that point what sort of non-disciplinary action the board's going to take. I mean, it could be a letter of concern, in which case I don't think we should be looking at priors. It could be non-disciplinary CE, in which case maybe we should be considering priors that fall in the same category. Like, you know, if the issue is endo, then if there's an endo-related prior, then yeah, let's look at it. But if there's a record-keeping-related prior, maybe not. I mean, it's not a prior for purposes of enhancing the disciplinary or non-disciplinary action. So I would just add a twist to Kevin's thought that I think there should be a motion and a vote from the board saying there that something warrants disciplinary action, at which point we look at all of the priors.
So, Jeff, before I call on you, let me just flesh this out for a second. I think part of my concern with that is, to put my practitioner hat on, I wouldn't want to see every violation have to get ratcheted up to disciplinary action. And I think this board has kind of found a good compromise a lot of times where there may be a violation in record keeping, but we're not looking for disciplinary action for that. So if, and maybe then I'm not a lawyer, and that's where maybe Addy, you, Jeff, or, you know, even Kevin can help me understand it better, where if we're using the term violation, are we talking about we found that there's unprofessional conduct or that there's a deviation of the standard of care? Or is there a difference?
So I think, at least in my mind, sorry to jump the gun, but at least in my mind, whether there is a violation is a very different question than whether something rises to disciplinary or non-disciplinary. Because, yeah, there's going to be some violation of something, you know, the ethics rules, some statute, or some standard of care. So the board is taking action only if there is a violation. But that encompasses all of the actions that the board takes, right? Letter of concern, okay. Non-disciplinary, CE, disciplinary. So in my mind, a motion saying there is a violation doesn't get us to the question of whether that violation warrants disciplinary action. So I think there needs to be that kind of a motion where if the board, a majority of the board or, you know, unanimous board says, yeah, there's cause for disciplinary action, then fine. Yeah, let's look at all of the priors. But if the board votes that there is cause for maybe some non-disciplinary action, then at least my view would be that we only look at priors that fall in the same category of the violation that we are looking at the moment. So let's say in the past, a dentist has some record keeping letter of concern and some risk management CEs. But if the case in front of us that we're thinking warrants non-disciplinary action is about endo, then those two, risk management and record keeping, aren't endo related. We would not consider those as priors for purposes of this particular thing that is in front of us. So that's kind of like where I stand on sort of what sort of practices or what sort of motions need to happen before we look at priors. I agree with Kevin's general approach that there needs to be a clear motion at which point then we can look at a prior, but what that motion looks like is where I have different thoughts than Kevin's probably.
So you would see it where a motion is made to establish there was a violation. Once, say, it's determined there was, then priors could be reviewed. But if there was a prior that was in a different category than the case in front of us, it should not be considered. Does that summarize your thought, Addy?
Right, and practically, I think, some cases are going to be, you know, we just dismiss those cases because we don't even see the violation there.
Right.
But once we are no longer thinking about a motion to dismiss, then we are thinking of some kind of non-disciplinary as sort of like the entry, like base level sanction to impose on the dentist, at which point I think we can look at priors from the same category. But then at some point in that discussion, if we are really thinking of disciplinary action, then at that point, I think there needs to be a clear motion saying we are going to go with a disciplinary action. And after that, we look at all of the priors, not just from any particular category.
Mm. Jeff.
I was trying to kind of meld Kevin and Addy together, and that would be, I would think, if there's a motion for a violation and the vote is yes, then the two possibilities would be non-disciplinary CE or unprofessional conduct. If the vote was turned down, then the two options would be dismissal or letter of concern. And I like Addie's approach that if it's non-disciplinary CE, you're only looking for priors in that category. If it's unprofessional conduct, then everything's on board.
So practically, would you see that working? And Ryan, this might be a question for you. If the board has established there's a violation and now we would just ask staff, has there been any priors in this category? And so if there's priors outside that category, the staff is not reporting that, or how would that work?
I say no.
Well, go ahead, Kevin. You got your hand up.
Well, yeah, I have my hand up because I think we really need to think of this as a three-step process. The first step is putting on the record what the findings of fact are. Because that's the way an order goes. An order has, it establishes findings of fact, and then you're gonna have discussion, and you're gonna determine whether or not the findings in fact are significant deviations from the standard of care that would then drive a violation. And then you're gonna move to penalty. The priors, I don't think it's possible for the staff to go back. First of all, they're for the most part not dental professionals.
Right.
And they really shouldn't put a spin on anything and decide, oh, yes, this and not that. So I think the board has to have access to all the information, because all the information would determine whether or not someone is, we used to use the term, someone is unregulatable. You remember that? That's a Julie Chapko term, Jeff, you know, that I had never heard before until I came to Arizona. But you do find that. You have folks that are, they just keep coming back again. They're frequent flyers. They're either silver, they're gold, or they're platinum. And at some point, there needs to be some consideration of more serious implications here.
Okay. So do we feel like we have a consensus on this? I mean, one thing I don't want to do is get into three motions per case and have 12-hour long board meetings where we're regurgitating all the findings of fact and, you know, treating it as though each one's almost a formal interview. Anthony.
But that's the process we're doing, right? So really steps one, two, and you could even say three are handled by the time they get to you as the full board. And your efficiency is in reviewing what the recommendations are from the IC. And then if you agree or disagree with those recommendations, right? But to Kevin's point, the findings of fact are presented to the IC through the consultant, right? They did the thorough investigative review. They spoke with the licensee. They spoke with the complainant. And I don't know what folks see, but it's maybe a 50-50, maybe a little bit more. I don't have enough knowledge to say, but usually the licensee is with their attorney or representative. But sometimes they're not. But the point being is that's all done and presented to the IC. So those are our findings of fact from the consultant. Then we start with this very process. So it's opened up. We first go through and decide what cases should just be dismissed and that recommendation to be made to the full board. And then the remaining cases, when we get to their discussion, it's opened with, was there a violation? And if that decision is made, then we enter into the very discussion that we've been having here and make our recommendations accordingly. So really, by the time they get to you, you shouldn't have that difficult of a time going through all of this, because hopefully we've done the heavy lifting for you as a committee.
Kevin?
Yeah, but on the other hand, too, if it comes out of the IC and then the board has certain findings of fact, you haven't had access to the testimony of the the subject dentist or what their defense is, so what those allegations are. So essentially they're allegations until you make a finding. And it could be that there is a clinical rationale for having done what they did, or there may be something that is pointed out in testimony that doesn't support all of the findings of fact that may have come out of the investigation committee.
I'll gently disagree, but I'm not saying that there's an opportunity. Obviously, we're not the decision makers, right? The board is the decision maker, but we are doing a fair amount of work, Kevin, and we are getting a fair amount of testimony. And I think we're able to create, again, we're just creating, our goal is to create an efficiency factor so that the board is not spending a tremendous amount of time in their adjudication process. So I think that, I guess I'm just trying to say that I think this process is happening, and it's not as burdensome for the full board because we've sort of allowed others to participate in that process.
That. Yeah, I accept that, and maybe I'm confused because my view of the investigative, maybe I'm unfamiliar enough with the investigative committee, but does the investigative committee have witnesses, have the subjects come before them? I mean, sort of like the old investigative
interviews.
Yeah, so it's not an II, but we have, like, we do conduct formal interviews if that is directed. If that's a decision we make, then, and we're just starting to do that. So I think this is an evolutionary process, but okay. I mean, I'm not, I don't know for sure. So I'll ask for Ryan or Anthony to confirm, but my sense is that the goal is to have the IC handle all the formal interviews, and so that if we determine during our deliberations that we want more information, we'll ask for an investigative interview with the licensee, and so we'll get more information at that time. We won't ask for that if we feel as though we have enough information via the report that was provided to us by the investigator and the discussion amongst the committee. And then we're making recommendations to the board to facilitate that process. So I think we're doing that, and that's maybe what you're, because that is different. And I know it's different than what was going on when you were there, for sure.
Yeah.
Addie?
I'm dying to hear what Jeff has to say, because there is a file from a filing cabinet.
what I was just going to say is just to read to the committee. This is a letter I just received yesterday about the March 7 committee, and it says in here, quote, this is a letter to the licensee, CC to me. While you are welcome and even encouraged to attend the committee meeting, the committee will not as in italics, be directed any questions to you, and therefore you will not, in italics, be granted an opportunity to address the advisory committee, unquote. So I don't even go to them since I can't do anything. I just listen to the audio tape afterwards.
And I don't really think we need to spend too much time on this, because regardless, the board still has to follow a certain format. And there are cases that come in front of us that the IC doesn't review. So I think we still need to map out a procedure or protocol for the board to follow to review these priors. And I like where we're headed. I think we just need to be able to articulate it in a way that maybe Ryan can get something written up, or if we can articulate it now and vote, then pass that on to the board. Addie.
So consensus on the committee, we are sort of like discussing in the margins, like some of the things, right? So I think the consensus is, in each case, we have to do more than one motion. And I hate to say this because, yeah, I mean, it makes meetings probably longer, but I'm also thinking practically some of those things can be done very quickly. I mean, we already do some of those things very quickly on the board. I mean, some cases are just clear cut. Yeah, this has to be disciplinary, or this has to be letter of concern. So, I mean, in in many cases, I think practically speaking, we can still go through those cases fairly at the same pace that we go through them right now. The only cases where this kind of a structure helps the board out is when there isn't a consensus on the board. And we need a mechanism to say, okay, we'll, you know, establish the findings of fact, which will say, okay, there, we think there is a violation, and then we will decide whether, you know, we are looking at non-disciplinary or disciplinary, at which point then we'll decide to look at priors, and based on that look at the priors, we'll decide what the action should be against the licensee. I think, I mean, some cases are just naturally wonky and fact intensive, or cases where there is maybe some disagreement on the board. And for those cases, I think this kind of a process helps us out quite a bit, which is to say, in the majority of the cases, you know, we wouldn't even have to do like a very structured, like 3-motion, 4-motion thing, because it would just naturally be cases where we are all agreed upon something.
And, you know, the format that I've been running lately, which I know some of the attorneys don't like, is the dismissals and the letters of concern are getting wrapped into the consent agenda. So for the most part, unless a board member is pulling a case out, it's agendized as either non-disciplinary or disciplinary. So I don't know if that, I don't know how that factors into the process of establishing a violation and where it falls. Meaning, certainly I know that if it's agendized for one thing, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, we're constantly voting differently on how it's agendized. But if it is agendized for non-disciplinary, is that enough once the board establishes they agree that at least there's a violation to then talk priors, or is this committee thinking that priors should not be discussed until we establish that it should rise to disciplinary? I'm still hung up on that right now. Addy, go ahead.
So I think, I mean, the way it is agendized doesn't really, at least in my mind, affect when we should be looking at the priors, because sometimes I've seen some disciplinary cases being dismissed for, you know, very good reasons. And sometimes I've seen cases that could be, you know, non-disciplinary 4RC and something, rising to disciplinary cases because of the discussion that occurs during the board meeting. So, I mean, I wouldn't hang anything on how the case is agendized. Okay. I would still look at, you know, what does the board think? And there needs to be a vote again. You know, if the board thinks there is some possibility of disciplinary action or non-disciplinary action, then I think that's when we look at priors.
Non-disciplinary or disciplinary?
Is that right? I should probably refine that, because I mean, it's letters of concern are non-disciplinary, but we aren't looking at priors. I think we are all agreed on that. But if you're thinking of some kind of continuing education credits, then maybe that's when. But my view is we look at only priors from that category, but I also see Kevin's point. You know, I don't want the staff to sort of make, you know, judgments as to what falls in the category and what doesn't. I haven't thought about that very.
And maybe that's the threshold. Maybe as soon as the board is thinking, well, you know, would this licensee benefit from some CE? You know, rather than talking non-disciplinary, since there's different categories within that, if the board is thinking that CE is going to help the licensee, maybe that's the threshold where we now consider priors.
Yeah, I like that.
Anthony?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, because this discussion has happened two ways. The first way it's happened is kind of along the lines of what we're doing is, if a violation is determined, then we allow priors to be identified, or we would like to have priors identified. I've also heard it proposed that if a violation is identified, that should immediately be a disciplinary response. And I think that we can allow ourselves from some nuance. And I think that when we introduce the discussion of priors, also embraces that nuance. And the nuance is, I think that our goal is to look at these complaints as objectively as possible, right? And so if we identify a violation, I do think it merits being looked at or still determined whether it's a non-disciplinary or disciplinary violation. I think what helps us by looking at the priors right when we identify that a violation has been identified or that occurred is that if in fact those priors are influencing what the current complaint is, that can direct that discussion accordingly. And I think that's what we look to those priors to, is to say, okay, we don't want someone doing the same thing over and over again. And if we keep giving them non-disciplinary CE, it doesn't seem to be working, right? And so I think understanding the priors at that point can allow us to say, okay, maybe we need to take action that's beyond just doing CE at this point because of what's happened in the past. And that's kind of how I look at it. So for me, I like the idea that once a violation has been identified, that priors then are allowed to be listed or discussed so that we can make the determination how that conversation goes forward.
I was kind of getting to this, to there as we're talking, because you could have, you know, we keep talking about non-disciplinary CE versus discipline being influenced by priors. Well, what if you had a licensee that had five letters of concern in risk management, and because we'd never be able to look at priors, we just keep doling out these letters of concern when some CE may help that. So I'm thinking more now, if, and it keeps it clean. Look, was there a violation? Yeah, there's a violation. Okay, were there any priors? And it could go the other way. You look and say, okay, look, this guy's been practicing for 30 years and he's never even had a letter of concern. Maybe we should just dismiss this case or not escalate it to even non-disciplinary. And that might keep things cleaner than trying to figure out, okay, well, there's a violation, but is it a letter of concern? And if it is, now we can't talk about priors or not. I'm kind of nudging towards that direction as we're talking. Just establish if there's a violation, regardless of what action the board's going to take. If there is a violation, look at priors. And now the board can be given guidance from this committee where look at length of time that they've been practicing. What has the prior been in before? I mean, if it was in endo and now we're talking crown and bridge, there should be less consideration for that. But I think it would keep the running of the meeting much cleaner to do it that way.
So, Anthony, are you saying then the first vote would be either dismiss or violation, and then once there's a violation, the priors would be read, and then the board can vote to either letter of concern, non-disciplinary, CE, or disciplinary?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I initially wasn't thinking, do we dismiss or was there a violation? But that's probably the best way to do it, because if we're thinking dismissal, there should not be a violation, right?
Right.
Although we do dismiss cases where there are violations. I mean, we have plenty of record keeping issues that are very small that we end up dismissing. So that's the only thing that could become an issue now is how can you vote that there's not a violation if there was a record keeping issue? So you're in, and now if you go, okay, there is a violation, there's a record keeping issue, and you look and there's no priors, they've been practicing for 20 years and they forgot to write down that they, what the diagnosis was. I think the board should still have the ability to dismiss that case. But I guess my concern is at that point, it's probably going to be a letter of concern because you've established there's a violation. And maybe that's the best approach. Maybe that is the cleanest approach though.
I mean, you could have situations where the record keeping is just deplorable, you know?
Right.
But if there's like one thing that may have been skipped or missed in a record, then you say, all right, then either a letter of concern or a non-disciplinary resolution that says, take a record keeping course. So I think there's ways to approach it, but I like where you're headed, Anthony, is that, okay, let's set a definitive point at which you move into where you consider the priors.
And I'm really approaching this. It's kind of hard for me not to, as when I'm sitting there running the meeting, how is it going to play out? And I think that's a clean way. But Addie, go ahead.
So I'm trying to think of sort of an alternative system and sort of think through how that system will play out, right? And maybe that thought experiment helps us come to some, you know, some concrete recommendations for the full board. So imagine, so right now with the board packet, we get the consultant's report and all of the documents that the in a particular case, but we also get a one-page board staff summary. And that board staff summary says, okay, you know, the IC recommended blah, blah, blah. In that summary, let's assume that the board staff puts one more sentence saying either there are no priors for this dentist or says there are priors. Doesn't say what the priors are, but just says there are priors or there are no priors. How would that affect the board's thinking or evaluation of the case going into the meeting? I think it would affect the evaluation quite a bit if I see in that staff the staff summary that there are priors, that's going to affect how I view the case. And that's really the danger that having is we can't use the fact that there is a prior and what the substance of that prior as a sort of a shorthand to decide the facts in front of us. I think that's the biggest concern I have. So that is why this discussion of when to consider priors is super important to me, because, you know, if we consider the priors prematurely, then this is going to color, I can tell you, colors my perspective on how the case plays out. I'm sure at least there's one of the board member whose perspective might be changed because of that. So that's why from my perspective, I don't want to know the priors until a point where we are really thinking about some action beyond just a letter of concern against the dentist. It has to be some kind of, at least there has to be consensus on the board that some kind of action by the board, CEs, hands-on, disciplinary, what have you, is going to help the dentist. At that point, I think, looking at the priors might help aggravate or help mitigate. But before then, I would have strong concerns about, you know, that coloring the whole, you know, evaluation of a case.
So, Ryan, before I get to you, could that look, again, we're in a meeting, could that motion look something like, or that discussion, is there a violation? And does that violation constitute greater action than a letter of concern? I mean, Seamus, do you want to jump in?
I don't want to cut Ryan off, but I was just thinking, listening to what you guys were saying, and thank you for letting me speak, that, you know, if you have somebody who gets a letter, right, you're going to give them a letter of concern because something's not in the record, and they have five of them before that. Well, if it's such a small thing that you're only going to give a letter of concern for it, then you probably shouldn't be looking at priors, right? Because that is such a small issue that you don't simply want to enhance it, again, to what Addie said, unless you really believe that that's going to rehabilitate the individual, if it rises, you know, to that level. And to that point as well, maybe another way you could look at this is, so again, these are sentencing enhancements. That's exactly how it should be looked at, to kind of separate it out. It shouldn't be looked at as, this is how we're determining this case. You've determined the case. Now you're looking at the sentencing. So if you believe that it rises to the level of non-disciplinary CEs, and that's what you're going to order, why not make that motion? And then when that motion is made, and the board can then ask for, you know, discussion, are there any other priors? If you wanted to make the motion in a way that would allow you to say, okay, we do believe we are going to motion for non-disciplinary. Are there any other priors in this exact same area for what we already made the motion for? That may be a way to get you there, so that you're not deciding what action to take based on those priors. You're already taking action and deciding whether to enhance it or not after you've already decided what action to take.
So, Seamus, just clarify that one more time for me.
Yeah, I apologize. There was a lot there.
No, yeah. And again, I'm sure Addy and Kevin and Jeff got that just fine. But
I don't know. Look at their faces. I think I confused them too.
So, Ryan, do you want to jump in before we keep going down this road?
Maybe I'll let Seamus unpack it.
Yeah.
One more time, and then, because I think I'm going to muddy it up, to be honest with you.
Okay. So just let's say you're taking a case and you make a motion that, you know, as we've discussed, you don't have to make a motion for a violation unless you are going to take action. But, you know, it sounds like that's something you guys want to continue to do, even with non-disciplinary. So you can find a violation and then say, okay, based on everything that we've looked at, everything that we've found, you're going to adopt, right? You're going to also, with non-disciplinary, you're not going to adopt facts. You're just going to say, based on the record, based on our discussion, and this is what I believe that should be ordered, right? And then you get a second, and then you say discussion.
And so at that point in discussion, we can ask staff, are there any priors?
And that could just be an option to get you a little bit farther ahead in the process, so that it keeps it more to just, you know, the disciplinary part and not any other thing else that came before that, right? Because you've already kind of determined this is the discipline we believe is necessary for this case. Now, have we ordered this exact same thing, not in the same time period, you know, before? And then you look at it, but again, it's just an option.
And say they come back and they say, there's five priors here, what they are, then the motion could be rescinded and remade and ratcheted up to disciplinary.
Say
we're non-disciplinary and we haven't voted yet. There's just a motion and a second. And now we find out there is no history in this. And now maybe the motion fails and it goes down to a letter of concern. It could flow that way, and that's kosher.
I mean, again, that's up to you guys. I'm just trying to help provide options that'll get you a little bit farther in your actual process, so that it feels a little more like you're not focusing on what happened prior to make your determination of what you're going to do in that case.
Okay. Addy.
I really like Seamus's approach. I mean, he concretized, it's fine if the motion has to be withdrawn or if the motion fails or, you know, whatever. I mean, yeah, we might see more motions being withdrawn once we find priors, or more motions failing if the person who is making the motion decides to call a vote. But that's fine. And I think that's an example of the process working.
Yeah, I like that. Can I hear from everybody's, your guys' thoughts on this? Kevin.
Yeah, I like it, you know, because I think that the decision-making process in the board, you're all going to look at these things through different lenses. You're going to, through your own dental experience and from other cases that you've looked at, and and work it through in your mind as where does this fit on the range of things that typically come through here? And that group discussion and that back and forth, I think, gets you to a point where you have consensus. And I think we're moving in the direction of where we need to go here to give guidance to the board and have something articulated on paper that, you know, this is how we're going to operate from here on out.
Jeff?
Yeah, so if I understand it then, so the first thing you could do is say that nothing here, dismiss. Right. But if somebody says the motion would be either letter of concern, non-disciplinary CE, or discipline, then the priors would come in, and then you could moderate it up or down depending on what you find out.
I think based on Seamus's comments, if we're thinking a letter of concern, that discussion probably wouldn't happen about priors.
Okay.
So if a motion was made for a letter of concern, seconded, we could have a discussion, but we're not going to bring up priors.
Okay.
If the motion is made for non-disciplinary with CE and moves to discussion, we could then start talking priors, which could let the motion pass or fail and go down to a letter of concern or disciplinary.
Yeah. I'm okay with that.
Okay. Anthony? Good. So, Ryan, with this being a, are you still with us, Ryan? So, I know we've spent a lot of time on this, but I think it's necessary because it's in the AG's audit and it has been a source of confusion on the board. How do we pass this information from committee to board at this point?
So here's where I think I'm going to muddy things up, not on purpose, but just to, maybe it is on purpose. So I've kind of worked with this format in a prior life. And I think, and I love Addie's point about the coloring of the picture, and trying to, like sometimes if you knew something ahead of time before you made a decision on a violation or not, that might color the picture in a different direction. So I can appreciate that for sure. And I think that is the best approach. If the board is the only, I'm going to say, adjudicator involved, they are the adjudicator, but you do have that step now before, which involves the investigative committee. And while they are not the final adjudicator, they are definitely making a recommendation to the board. And then it's up to the board whether or not they believe or trust the process that the investigative committee has done, and the investigation to that point. So my thought, and here's where the things get a little muddy, is that it's where you put your trust. Do you trust that the investigative committee has done the homework and viewed the investigation as thoroughly as possible without the input, to Jeff Connor's point, of the licensee to this point, other than a possible phone call throughout the investigative process? And so what the investigative committee is doing is they're looking at the totality of the investigation to that date, and they are already making two different motions. One is if there is a violation, there's a motion, and then two, what is the recommendation? The second one, the recommendation, does not include a review of the history because they're literally just making a recommendation on what's in front of them. They don't get the benefit of looking at priors. All they've noticed is that there's a violation, and this is what we're recommending. So the board is only getting the recommendation from just that one aspect. My thought is if the committee comes up with a violation, then the board staff would have homework after the committee meeting. And after the committee meeting, and we can add a second sheet to the staff memo, or put it at the bottom of the memo. I mean, and then board members wouldn't, whatever. But I think because you now trust that the committee, you trust the system, they found the violation, they're only recommending this, but if you want to ratchet it up because there was previous violations, then that would be the board's prerogative. Once it goes to the board, you would be the only ones that would get the priors. But I think it prevents the board meetings from going longer than they have to be, or the forgetfulness of, oh, we forgot to see if there was priors. I think that's the biggest issue with the Auditor General's report. They're saying the board is not looking at the history of a complaint if there was a violation. And I think the only way to get there, and without, and to Addie's point, but I don't think we're coloring anything, because I think it's a trust system that you're trusting that 11 people that are all clinicians found a violation. And because of that, staff is now giving the prior history.
Questions?
I have concerns with that. I mean, I appreciate, Ryan, your position. I mean, I have concerns with that because in the board packet that I get, I don't want to see any mention of priors at all, or even that there have been no priors. I just don't want any of that. And it's not because I trust or distrust the investigative committee. I mean, they do an excellent job and, you know, it really helps out. But statutorily, the board is responsible for doing this, you know, taking a fresh look at all of this. So yes, the investigative committee helps a lot. And, you know, we rely more often than not on the findings of the investigative committee, but the buck stops with the board. And that's where my concern is. I mean, we have to look at a case with fresh eyes without being, you know, swayed either way by giving us this history of the prior. So, I mean, I appreciate that, you know, the Auditor General's report at least like flags the issue that, hey, we should be thinking about, you know, the proper time to look at priors, but I would not be looking at, you know, that if it comes in the board packet. And if it comes in the board packet, I mean, you can't unsee what you see. So that's a big danger. I would stay away from it.
And Ryan, because you do bring up a good point about the board just maybe forgetting to ask. But I think if we get in the habit of during the discussion, you or another board staff just jumps in and says, do you want to hear about priors? Or would you ask, like, because you did that at the last meeting. After a couple times of that, the board was hopefully smart enough to remember to start asking for it. I think we would, which would maybe resolve your concern. Kevin, go ahead.
I'm just wondering how the Auditor General came to this conclusion. Was it not articulated in the board's minutes that you consider priors? How did they know whether they were or they weren't considered? Because they made a substantive finding, but how would they know whether or not you did that? Listen to recordings?
They sat through like three meetings, maybe four.
Okay.
If I can, I think April's on the phone today. I'm not sure if she's here or not, but April is, yes, she is. She's the new chief compliance officer. She is not shy to jump in. And so she would be, I'm not certain, happy or thrilled is the adjective, but she would be comfortable interrupting to say this person has a prior history. And then she's already prepared every single meeting to give that information. So that's fine as well. April, I don't want to speak for you. If you want to jump in, feel free.
April, why don't you go ahead and then Jeff, I'll get to you.
I'm done.
Okay.
I'm good.
So I just want to say that I have no problem when the board reaches the proper moment of the discussion to jump in and ask if you want to hear the priors. The only thing that I've heard that I'm not quite comfortable with is the idea of giving priors of in a specific area. Because as to Kevin's point, staff wouldn't know how to identify that.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I don't think staff should be trying to discern that. April, what I would say is once there's a motion and a second for non-disciplinary action and we move to discussion, that's when to jump in. Or if I say roll call, because sometimes we don't – if I don't think there's a discussion that's really going to happen, I'll – kind of bulldog past that, and you're just going to have to interrupt me and ask that question at that point.
Okay, that shouldn't be a problem. Is this something that is effective immediately?
Well, so that's, I guess that's a question for Ryan and or Seamus. I mean, we're a committee, you know, is this something the board would need to discuss and vote on, or is this something we can just start doing?
You are here to provide recommendations to the board, and so the whole board would then vote on it, would look at it and decide.
Can we agendize this on the next meeting, Ryan?
Yeah. Yasmin's here, and she's the one that takes your minutes, and we will amend the board agenda, Jeff, for another issue for Jeff as well. So we will add this to the amendment that will be posted on next Wednesday.
Okay, perfect. And Ryan, I know you got to go at 4:30.
Yeah, thanks for being present, guys. I appreciate it. I'm going to jump off, but Christina's present and Sherry as well. So they'll do a great job in my absence. So I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And before I forget, happy birthday, Sherry.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yay.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want me to adjourn, or do you want to try to go till 5 o'clock?
Let's see if we can get more done.
Yeah, we're here. I think so. Okay. So that question, point number two, I don't know how much there is for us to discuss or even vote on with this. I think it was just more getting a better understanding of what the board's options were once disciplinary action was being ordered. And, you know, I'll open it up for conversation, but I don't think this committee's necessarily advising the board on anything this other than these are our options, but let's talk through that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm looking at so you're referring to the question whether the investigative committee may review priors?
I'm looking below that. I was looking
the answer to that question is easy, and I think Ryan said the committee is not looking at it, which is the right answer, I think.
Right. So I was on page 5. Oh, I see where you're looking at, number 2 under that one. So question point 2, disciplinary sanction options the board has besides continuing education.
Thank you.
I know with this one, we talked about probation. Jeff, I like the point you brought up, how that can lead to just the significance of it with insurance carriers dropping you and that. So I do think the board should know that. Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I was just going to say, too, the other thing I think is I see a bunch of disadvantages for the licensee. I don't really see any advantage for the board itself. Because if you have a prior order and it was violated, you're going to ratchet that up whether the first order contained probation or not. So I don't really see the advantage to it. And if I were allowed to rewrite the Dental Practice Act by myself, I would just take probation out.
I guess the benefit I saw, so again, this sparked from the audit that said something about the board not doing its job to protect the public by doling out appropriate disciplinary action. Where I do see this potentially being effective is there's cases we have where disciplinary action with CE just seems inadequate, but suspension or revocation, suspension or summary suspension seems too much. And that's where I like having some other options in between those two. I don't know that it would be frequently used, but I could see instances where it's effective. I guess my point is, I don't know. I mean, I guess the committee could comment on what the consequences potentially could be, when it could be appropriate, but this isn't really something we're recommending to be instituted or not. The board has it at its discretion anyway. So sure. I guess part of it is I'm not sure what, and that would fall even into the other point we talked about with practice monitoring and the use of credits and that. The committee could comment on it, but we're not really, we could advise the board, but we're not really trying to implement something or not. Anthony.
I want to say I think I understand what Jeff's saying in that based on the mechanisms that are in place, probation really doesn't have any value, right?
Yes.
Because if you are going to suspend a license, as an example, that suspension is going to be for X period of time. And that's going to be predicated on the findings that you identified and felt appropriate for the action. So the thing less than that potentially would be this idea of, well, we're not going to suspend you, but we're going to put you on probation. But you're already doing that, right? If you could actually look at the whole process as being somewhat probationary in the case, under the perspective of looking at priors, right? Because if you say, okay, we're going to decide if this is a disciplinary, if this is a violation, and what will take us from non-disciplinary to disciplinary? Well, we're going to look at your priors. But isn't that in and of itself kind of a probationary thing? That probationary issue has been following them since their last disciplinary action, right? Because it says in those disciplinary actions, this can come back up again, right? Isn't just by the nature of saying we can bring this up again and look at it indicate that that's probationary? And I think that's what he's kind of saying is, why even have it in there when you're sort of functioning that way? We're not really ever putting anybody on probation because they're kind of already on probation already by virtue of having a violation in their record. So correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Kevin?
Yeah, I think of probation as a conditional thing. Like certain things have to be done for a period of time. And then once the licensee has done those things and the probation is lifted, or you could have a situation where something is relatively egregious. And let's say you impose a practice restriction for a period of time. And if another violation occurs within that period of time, then a suspension becomes active because you could have a stayed suspension, for example. And then under a stayed suspension, you're effectively on probation. And if something happens in the interim there, then the hammer comes down. And these are, I think, things that are happening in more egregious situations. And then you also have practice restrictions that you put on. Let's say, okay, you don't do any third molar endo until you do this remediation.
Addie.
Addie, real quick, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Mani, and if I could just jump in. Just as a high level comment to this probationary discussion, you know, there are legal questions surrounding the board's ability to issue a disciplinary agreement with terms that doesn't have a period of probation to it. Including in your statutes, it says the order fixing a period in terms of probation may require that restitution may be paid to the aggrieved party. And then your question of restrictions as well. Under a practice restriction, that's going to be a disciplinary act that's going to require some kind of probation in order to affect it. So, you know, these are obviously high level questions that can be looked at down the road, but just to keep that, in the front of your mind when you're talking about this stuff.
Thank you, Seamus. Addie.
So I think, I mean, my thinking is pretty much what, Dr. Hero, you were mentioning. I mean, I don't know what we as the committee can contribute as a recommendation to the board. I mean, the thing is, in the statute, probation is one of the options available to the board. I have never seen a probation case in my time on the board. And maybe for good reasons. And, you know, I agree with Jeff's assessment. I mean, probation just ruins the practice. I mean, and in some cases, it might be appropriate for the board to, you know, take summary suspension or, you know, think of revocation of the license, which not just ruins the practice, but it's a death penalty for the practice, right? That's the maximum thing we can do. So I think given the historical practice of the board not having looked at probation, I'm fine with keeping it that way. because in those egregious cases, I think the board reaches the right decisions in either having some kind of disciplinary action that gets reported to the national practice database. I think that's a sufficient deterrence to the licensee to, you know, make some major changes in the way they practice. I don't think probation on its own achieves any rehabilitation goal, which is sort of, you know, the main reason the board takes any action to begin with. And in the rare cases where we are thinking of revoking a license, I think that's the right decision as opposed to probation. But I mean, I can also see sort of in a case where we are thinking of summary suspension or revocation of a license, the licensee would then instead have an interest in having probationary status rather than just revocation of the license. I mean, I can totally see the licensee making the argument for probation. And if that comes up, I mean, we'll deal with it when it comes up in that posture. But if the licensee doesn't ask for probation and we are thinking of revocation, and if the board goes ahead with revocation, I think that would be the right decision. I wouldn't lose any sleep over it.
I think how I was thinking about it was well articulated by Kevin, where if we have licensees where we're looking at instituting some type of practice monitoring, like I think we had one the last meeting where there was significant record keeping issues on multiple cases. So maybe it wasn't that one, but you know, if you were going to say, okay, well, look, you need hands-on CE in endodontics. Well, you know, the better example, and I'm thinking out loud, so just hang in there with me. Years ago, there was a death with a dental anesthesiologist, and he was on practice monitoring for a few years where he would meet with the dental anesthesiologist, I think it was quarterly, and have his cases reviewed. That's the kind of scenario I could see. Well, maybe the license is on probation during that defined period of time while practice monitoring has been ordered. And then once it's completed, it's taken away. Go ahead, Addie.
I mean, I see where you're coming from, and I can think of some of those cases, but I still lean in favor of just doing practice monitoring without probation, because that achieves all of the purposes of the board. We want someone objective, you know, third party to look at the practice every quarter, every month, whatever the case is, and really guide the dentist through, you know, whatever needs to be changed in the practice. I don't think probation achieves that. Probation just reduces the amount of patients that the dentist can see. It withdraws the services of the dentist from for all practical purposes from the marketplace.
So, before we spend any more time on this, then, because again, we're in committee. I don't know it's worth hashing this out much more, unless, and Seamus, maybe you can answer part of this. Should the committee comment on just its general thoughts on this, or should we just kind of move on, and if it comes up in a board meeting, the board members can hash it out, we can give our opinions and go from there?
Well, Dr. Hero, again, this is Seamus. Sorry, I just switched to my phone. You know, I think that's really up to you guys, and I don't want to curtail, you know, what you're doing or any of your recommendations, because as you know, if the board doesn't want to consider it, they don't have to. So you know, if you want to make the recommendation, you can make the recommendation. I did want to clarify though, that this board, even since I've been put on this board within the last say 6 to 8 months, we have had, you know, it probably at least 5 maybe 10 people put on probation, probably not closer to 10, but we have utilized the probation. And especially in circumstances where you're going to order a chart audit, that's exactly where you're going to, or monitoring, that's when you're going to have probationary status to effectuate that.
Huh. Thank you, Seamus. Anthony, do you have a comment?
I'd say that's an interesting comment that Seamus mentioned. So, but I was just going to tell you that, you know, based on the case that you brought up, you know, one of the ramifications of that anesthesiologist being on that probationary period was access disallowed them to see any patients through that coverage. So it effectively significantly decreased their ability to practice. So, you know, it is pretty impacting when you do things like that. So just something to consider.
Jeff.
Yeah, I think as long as the board knows the ramifications of probation and its possible effects on the licensee, then I'm okay with that. And don't forget, it's not just a, well, for some dentists, it's not just potentially losing payment sources. But if you're an associate dentist and you have it in your contract that a termination for cause is probation, they could actually lose their job. So as long as they know that.
Addie, before I get to you, again, we're advising the board, should something be written up about what probate, about the potential ramifications of, Jeff, can I, you know, put that on you? Maybe you could write
something
up.
Happy to do that.
We could look at it at the next committee meeting. We approve it. Then at least the board has that knowledge.
Yep.
Addie?
Yeah, I think, I mean, just again, we are talking maybe in the margins now. I agree with the general approach. I think putting the ramifications of probation in front of the board would be helpful. And that's, you know, maybe the work product that this committee, you know, forwards to the full board on this particular issue. My personal view is, again, if we are, I mean, if revocation is like death penalty, then probation is like life without parole. So if you're thinking of, you know, something like disciplinary action with practice monitoring, that's just a sentence for 3 years or 18 months or whatever, right? So if you're thinking of saying that all of those 18-month, 3-year sentences are now life without parole sentences, I would have problem with that. So that's really where I'm thinking probation is. And again, I may be wrong in thinking about probation as life without parole, but if that assumption is right, then I think that's just sort of one step below revocation, and that just very rarely happens. And in cases where we do, you know, order practice monitoring or some kind of, you know, within 12 months, you have to do disciplinary continuing education, 26 hours, whatever. Those are nowhere close to probation or probation cases, at least in my mind, but just wanted to.
So just to help me understand that better, then if the order is that they're on probation for a defined period of time, 6 months, after that 6 months, does that still impact their ability to contract with insurance payers and potentially become employed in another practice?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm thinking in terms of, you know, I have a lawyer license. So if a lawyer gets probation dinged on their license, they have to continue to disclose it for life. Every time, you know, anywhere they practice, any court in which they enter appearance, they have to, you know, say, you know, when they get PHP admission, for example, Prohak Vichy admission, they have to disclose, oh, I have, at some point in the past, I've been on probationary status. That's a very big deal. Affects insurance. It affects, you know, the kind of disclosures you have to give to clients, to the court. So I think, I mean, if it's the same kind of probationary status in the dental profession, then yeah, it's life without parole, really.
How is that? I mean, would we find unprofessional conduct with disciplinary action? That goes in the National Practitioner Database, correct?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's, that's disclosed and everything as well. So that does follow them around. So, I mean, the fact that it follows them around, you know, that's not outside what we're typically doing. It'd be good to get more information on this, though.
But Anthony, there are four items that what the insurance companies look at: suspension, revocation, restriction, and probation. Those are the killers.
Okay.
And then, of course, the other thing is if they're an associate with a contract, that's termination for cause, and they lose their, you know. So on a Friday, you vote to put them on probation. On Monday, their employer says you're gone for cause. You're done. So they could lose their job.
Kevin?
You know, I think public safety has got to be our major consideration here. And just because someone can't be credentialed as an in-network provider for an insurance company doesn't mean that they still can't see patients and bill out of network and get paid. So, I mean, that shouldn't be like the only consideration that you think about. You know, because it's not exactly a death sentence because there are other avenues, and people have had sanctions that have been thrown off of networks because they have discipline on their record. That doesn't mean they still can't see patients and bill with them on an out-of-network basis. It's whether they're in-network or not in-network.
And that's a good point. And I don't think we need to belabor this anymore. I think it's, regardless of what the committee decides, it's a tool the board can use, and the board can discuss it on, you know, a case if they feel it's appropriate and go from there. But with that said, Jeff, I think it's good to if you don't mind, write something up, because the board should be informed on what that means.
And I agree. As long as the board knows what it is, they can decide whether or not to impose it.
Okay. Okay. So, question point three, this Dr. Morrow asked this last time, and I know he's discussed this in board meetings before about that idea of like to like. I'd love to hear Addie and Jeff, your guys' comments on that, where specialist to specialist, general dentist to general dentist. My understanding in a board format where we sit is you're just talking standard of care, and that standard I didn't think it changed whether you're an endodontist or a general dentist, for example, doing a root canal.
Well, okay, so first of all, there is the Arizona statute that says there are two standards of care. Whether the board has to do it or not, I always kind of thought it is, to be honest with you. I expect an expert to do a better job than a generalist in his or her particular area. And I kind of think it is. I remember one time there was a endodontist, and the board said that he should have two diagnoses, pulpal and periradicular, where they didn't require that for a general dentist. We only needed the pulpal diagnosis. So I honestly think there are two standards.
Okay. Kevin, any comment on that?
I agree with that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so the issue really is, this issue is going to come up with the investigative committee, not so much with the board, I think. Because at the board level, I agree with Jeff and Kevin. I mean, there are two standards, one for a generalist and one for a specialist. But, if the investigator or the investigative committee is looking at a specialist doing a generalist's job, then I guess that's where I think Dr. Morrow was going. I fall back to the idea that the buck stops with the board. And so long as the board is applying the proper standard of care, you know, I think there isn't any issue. And I think the board has been applying the proper standard of care in all of these cases. So I can't recall a situation where, there was a huge, you know, problem with the right approach to take in a particular case.
You know, and I think a good example of this thing with things that are approaching the standard of care is the use of the CBCT to guide your implants. So there's more of a proliferation of people that are using CBCTs. I had the question come up for Brandon Brown twice in the last 2 weeks is, okay, well, if I don't have this scan read by an oral maxillofacial radiologist or an oral surgeon and some pathology appears on the scan, am I liable for it? You know, and so now I think we're seeing more and more general dentists who are doing implants are saying, oh no, I need to have a CBCT. But then are you, on the other hand, are you potentially exposing them to potential liability even board wise because there could be some kind of an artifact on there that they didn't notice or some pathology that's on there that they didn't notice and something happens to the patient later on. That's going to come back in a board case and come back in professional liability cases. You're shaking your head, Anthony.
It's a very perplexing issue for me. I mean, yeah. Actually, this just came up with the airway fire case. You know, the consultant reported back to the board that they didn't feel as though the dentist had any responsibility because the manufacturer of that laser had indicated that it couldn't ignite oxygen. And so, and it did. What do you do with that? You know, so, I mean, so it's this idea of what should you know and at what level should you know it? And gosh darn it, when a patient gets hurt, you scratch your head. I mean, I think it's really hard to kind of draw that. And I get it. I mean, it's very emotional too, right? I mean, if someone gets hurt, certainly death is the worst outcome. And it becomes very emotional and we want to do something. And as we reflect on our meeting this past week with the senator,
oh boy.
The emotions was there, but boy, if somebody did something unknowingly and didn't really have the information, can you hold them responsible? And then I translate that to the specialist thing in that are we saying that a general dentist can do a root canal at less of a level than an endodontist or that a more complex? We just discussed this too at our last IC meeting where the feeling was that by the oral surgeons on the committee that dentist should have referred that case versus doing it. And that complication very likely would have been avoided. This is tough. I don't know. Cause then when you say there's two standards of care and if that's in statute, is that what I heard you say, Jeff?
In Arizona law, if you have a civil malpractice case, only a general can testify for or against a general and a specialist for or against a specialist.
Right. I think it's a little bit of a challenge for us. And I just think we have to be thoughtful about it. You know, I mean, what's acceptable and what's not. And I think that's the challenge sometimes that I see when we do these investigations, particularly on the investigator side. Because, you know, these, for the most part, I don't think we have any specialist investigators, do we?
I think they're
all general dentists.
Oh, yeah, the staff investigators are all general dentists.
Yes. April has the answer, I think.
Actually, yeah, Dr. Hero is correct. The contract investigators are general dentists. And then we have the other category who we call consultants. And that's where we find our specialists.
Right. Where I'm going with that, though, is a lot of times these investigators, they're looking at this through the lens of what they know as a general dentist. And so we have to discern. I mean, I find myself oftentimes asking questions as staff knows, because I've done it, is I don't want to hear that this could have been a local anesthesia overdose, because the question that was never asked was, what was the weight of the patient? You know, and it's not in the chart. So we can't have that discussion until we know the weight of the patient. So it's challenging. This is just a challenging issue for me. And I try to be thoughtful about it, and I get it, but it is a challenge. That's all. That's just lots of different thoughts out there, but that's kind of where my head's at.
Addy.
So just like, because we have only 3 minutes, I'll tell you a story. So my very first board meeting, one of the things that was on my mind, the topmost on my mind, was this precise issue. And I still haven't found a very good answer to this. The answer I received back then was, well, the board decides the standard of care. And the board is comprised of, you know, people with different experiences. I mean, I'm a public member, right? I'm not a dentist. As the board is setting the standard of care. So if the board feels like in this particular case, this is the standard of care, and then that standard of care was breached, that is what it is, because, you know, not because the board is, you know, has some superhuman capabilities, but because that's how it is structured. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer. I have struggled with it, but, you know, we should definitely continue talking about that.
Do we know what the medical board does?
Part of what I wonder is, how does this relate back to, I mean, is this within kind of the purview of the committee right now? I mean, I think it's a great discussion. I think it's an important discussion, but if what we're trying to do is kind of methodically work through the concerns the Auditor General brought up, I just don't know how much of this discussion relates to that. Anthony.
Well, I think in light of what we've been discussing, I think exactly the system that we have in place is appropriate. I think it's appropriate to have our general dentist investigators. We do have specialists that sit on the IC. And then in those events where a consultant outside of the investigators is identified or requested, I think it's appropriate that if that is in an area of a specialty, that it would be appropriate to have a specialist review that. So I'm kind of fine with how we do it, and I think that system, I think that works. I mean, I think that it makes sense, and I think it's appropriate. So I'm in favor of what we're currently doing.
I am too. And frankly, now it's even more robust, the review, because of the IC. And when we structured the IC, we tried to get just about every specialist represented on that. And I just can't think of any cases that have come up with us in front of the board where there's been a discussion amongst the board where, or an argument, or even a discussion where, yeah, general dentist did it, but, you know, it's met the standard of care because it was a general dentist. Had it been a specialist, it would have been below it. Just, I don't know. I think it's a thought provoking discussion. I don't know that we need to belabor this point, you know, to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish, would be my thought on it. What I'd like to do, Christina, is at the next meeting, let's agendize it. So, one of the first things we're looking at are the guidelines for adjudicating complaints that staff have prepared. We didn't get to that today. And then let's also make sure Mr. Tonner, the information he's going to write out for us, we get to that. And then I asked Ryan about agendizing the discussion that the recommendations that the committee has today regarding priors gets on Friday's meeting.
Anthony, are you going to put that at the beginning? So if it's passed, you can do it during the meeting, or are you going to put it at the end so you can do it on the 31st?
You know, that's a good point. I mean, I think we should try to put it right at the beginning. I know Mr. Tonner has some cases that, you know, we'd really like to utilize that. I'm just joking. But I think it'd be good to put it at the beginning.
He'll have to recuse himself.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, any potential items you guys want to see put on a next meeting? Mm-hmm. I think we got enough going that we're going through right now. You know what, Christina, what I'd like some comment on for the next meeting, to me, it was these first couple points in the auditor's report that I thought were going to take the most time. Some of the other ones Ryan has said in the past, in private discussions I've had with him, that he thinks it's already been addressed. So if we can get some comment on that, because we may be able to wrap the committee up sooner than later, if that's true.
Are you referring to findings?
Which
findings?
Where the like there was a finding that the board, like the conflict of interest one, the one about not responding timely to complaints. I think we've already addressed both of those, but.
Yes, we have.
Just if we can get comment on that. So if we're able to potentially wrap up at the next meeting, that'd be, I think everybody would be in favor of that.
Yeah. And I'd like to thank
you can do that.
For the guidelines that you just circulated today. I think that's really a well thought out process that I'm looking forward to discussing next time.
Great.
Thank you.
Agreed.
Good. Then right.
All right. Good. So just for staff, I'm not going to be available on March 23rd. But you guys can take care of that. I'm supposed to show up in a tuxedo at the National Portrait Gallery in DC. So.
Oh, wait a minute. I may have a conflict then, too.
As do I. I'm right. Around the 23rd.
Okay, well, then that's going to be canceled. Yasmin, maybe you could circulate an email trying to find a new time.
Will do.
Thank you. Then we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care. Have a good night.
Have a great night. Thanks so much, guys. Bye.